I don't know, after that introduction, I don't know what I'm going to say. You're leaving me speechless there. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a happy alcoholic named Rich Dyke.
Hello, Rich.
And by the grace of God in this fellowship, I haven't necessarily taken a drink or a mood-changing drug today. And for that, I'm very grateful. You know, I had a friend of mine who said, you know, in the doctor's opinion, they use that word phenomenon. And I stand before you a phenomenon, a sober alcoholic. That's a miracle. I am not supposed to be sober. I suffer from this disease of alcoholism. I'm supposed to be dead. I'm supposed to be in jail. I'm supposed to be wherever, but not standing here, a sober alcoholic. And I like the way those of you, quite a few of you will hear me repeat myself because you've heard this stuff before, but my friend, brother Alexis used to describe phenomenon this way. If you see a cow grazing in the field, chewing his cud, that is not a phenomenon. If you see a bird sitting on the fence post, singing a beautiful song, that is not a phenomenon. If you see a thistle growing in that field, that is not a phenomenon. But if you see a cow sitting on a thistle, singing like a bird, that is a phenomenon. And that's a sober alcoholic. I have a sobriety date, September 15th, 1974. And that's a lot of 24 hours that AA and God have blessed me with. I have a home group, as was mentioned, the Any Length group. We meet at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning in Culpeper, Virginia at the Reformation Lutheran Church. The group got its name because you got to be willing to go to any length to show up at Saturday morning at 7 a.m. That's not a time people show up. And we get 15 to 20 people every Saturday morning. It's a powerful meeting. We study the big book. So I have a home group. I have a sponsor and I sponsor people. And I have a sobriety date. That's the most important thing, the sobriety date. Without that, you know, if you don't have the old timers told me, if you don't have a sobriety date, it means you don't have one. You know, so hang on to your sobriety date. That's an important date. You know, I'm thinking, how do I? I'm 76 years old, so I came in at 29. So you can do the math. I'll do it for you. And I was very fortunate to get here early in life. And how do I get 76 years of life into, what'd you say, Sam, 2 hours I got? I guess, you know, and another kind of story is I'm on a second marriage and I've been married 42 years, coming up on 43. And my wife has never seen me drink. We talk about, you know, maybe there's 7 to 10% of the population that are alcoholic. And the other percentage of the population, 90 to 93%, most of them can drink normally or not drink at all. They can take it or leave it. And my wife, she's never seen me drink. You know, I told her a little bit about my past. You know, I was a pretty wild kid and I told her that, but she knew me sober. And of course, I'm not even sure she believed some of the stories I told her. She probably thought I was just making them up. And so she went, we used to go to meetings together before we were married, a big speaker meeting on Saturday night. We'd go out for ice cream afterwards. And I guess she thought I seemed like a nice guy. And I was about 5 years sober when I took on a wife and her four kids. And I had custody of my son. That's five kids at home. Well, she had three at home. And my son, so we had four kids at home. And so she knew a little bit about AA. She'd been to meetings, she heard all the stories. Well, when I was asked to speak at that meeting, we were married about 6 months, and this is a true story. I was asked to speak at that meeting, and I got done, she was there. It's the first time she heard me tell my story. And she listened to that story. And when I got done, and this is God's honest truth, she said to me just like this. She said, if I had known that, I never would have married you. And she was dead serious. But she stayed with me, you know. And bless her soul, I told her the other day, you know, since I started drinking early, maybe I was about a 16-year-old neophyte in AA emotionally when she married me, and she had to watch me grow up. But you know, we're not all bad people. So there were good points there. And that's what she said. And so I'm blessed to have her in my life. I have to back up. I have to go back into my early childhood, and I'll try to be brief and keep my drinking stuff really brief. I was just reading a book, it was a Navy SEAL book, but a lot about research and what they're doing with PTSD and helping veterans go through that. And they have found out that they call it ACE, acute childhood events come back much later in life for so many people. And so these people, veterans that are, you know, not alcoholic, but going through PTSD, going through real trauma, and their childhood comes back and haunts them. And they have to go way back into all this stuff. And so I found it very interesting, because I find the longer I'm in AA and the older I get, that a lot of stuff can creep back in. And I have to be cognizant of that. The other thing they know is there is a high instance of suicides among veterans, among older people, and amongst recovered alcoholics and addicts as they get older. For me, it's not bad. It just means I really have to stay close to AA and what it's given me and what I've learned. If I go back now, I learned early on that looking at childhood events, looking at my upbringing, some people come into AA with very, very brutal upbringing. And a few have even good upbringing, and every place in the middle. My parents weren't bad. My father was probably an alcoholic, but he could just drink during the day, and he'd work two or three jobs to raise his family and pay for the house, because he cooked hamburgers. He didn't have any education. And my poor mother, I'm number two out of the chute. My older brother was not taking his inventory. He was pretty bad, but I was 10 times worse. And my mother didn't know what to do with us. So I was not going to do anything that anybody asked of me that I should be doing. I was a liar and a thief right out the chute. So my poor mother, I put her through hell. And now they call it opposition disorder. If she said, go down to the mailbox and turn right, I turned left and went off in the woods, and they wouldn't see me all day. I was doing that at 6 years old, 7 years old, you know. And that was just normal behavior for me. I was just going to be off doing my thing. I didn't get along with my parents. I didn't get along with other kids in school. I didn't get along with my teachers. And that went for a while. So I had a couple significant events in my life. And, you know, what I remembered early on and before I got into AA or first got into AA, what I really remembered about my childhood was being told, you rotten SOBs, you're no good. You know, and that was my mother talking about me and my brother, of course. And what I realized much later on is everything I thought about my childhood, this is my story, not everybody's, everything I thought about my childhood was really a figment of my imagination. It wasn't real. I didn't know that at the time. And that's not true for everybody, because some of you have really bad childhood upbringing, but this is mine. Not that that wasn't said. So I had a significant event in my life. We had a predator in the neighborhood who liked to prey on young boys. I don't know how old I was. I blanked out a lot of my childhood, but it carried over till I was into my early teens. And so it was a real event in my life. And that did not cause me to be an alcoholic. It caused me to have emotional problems. It caused me not to get along. It caused me not to know how to relate and not to have to learn how to have friends, how to get along with people. It caused me those kind of problems, but it did not cause me to be an alcoholic. I liked alcohol and the taste of it and what it did for me from the first time I tried it. So the next significant event, after I probably had a few tastes of beers and whatnot in my life, was I was about 10 years old. And now I'm 76. So 66 years ago, we had a small house. There were four kids in it, no dining room or anything. My grandparents lived there. And my dad and my granddad liked to drink shots and beer chasers in the small house. In the living room was a little coffee table. They opened that coffee table up, and there were these bottles of brown liquid in there. And I got a keen alcoholic mind and memory bank. I can picture the labels to this day. Three feathers and four roses. They were cheap whiskey back then. And I can remember nobody must have been around, and I took a big swig of that bottle. And I knew I felt a warm glow all the way down to my toes. Everything was okay at that moment in time. I've been in a lot of AA meetings, a lot of speaker meetings, and I hear people having blackouts, getting sick, and doing all that with their first meaningful drink. That's what I remember about mine, is that warm glow. It was significant. I never could drink normally from that moment on. Now, the only definitions in the big book from the first 100 people are, can you just stop drinking? You mean like forever? I couldn't. Can you control your drinking? Well, if I can't stop, I can't control it. That's for sure. When I start drinking, I cannot stop. I go right through that oblivion. So the next significant event in my life was... About a year later, coming home from Sunday school one day and telling my parents, I am done with church. I am never setting foot in church again. There is no God. I'm done with that business. And nobody, until I got into AA, nobody was going to be able to talk to me about anything spiritual, about God in my life. Religion, forget it. It wasn't there. I was in Vietnam. I was a helicopter pilot. We were sitting around after flying missions. And I'll never forget this guy, Larry Finnegan. I know he doesn't mind me using his last name. He's not an alcoholic, not one of us. He's a good guy. He said to me, Rich, how can you look up there in the stars, in the sky, in the universe, and say there's nothing bigger than you? Well, I got this keen alcoholic mind. I got all the answers. Now, of course, I'm half lit up. And my only answer was, I don't know, but there is. That's the best I could muster, but that's all I had to offer. Anyway, so I got out of the God business and out of the spiritual business. School, I was always out in left field. 13, 14, anytime we could cut school and get in somebody's house where we knew there was a liquor cabinet, I might get drunk. That might happen once a month or every other month or, you know, whenever I could. But by the time I was 15, I was getting drunk pretty much every weekend. I never got a DWI or DUI, but by the time I was 16, I was driving drunk every weekend. I was a puking blackout drinker. That was just my life. You know, my friends were alcohol would kind of warm them up, and we'd go to a disco, they could dance. I'd just go right into the shell. I'd just go right by that moment. It would go so fast. I was always thought of depression. I was always depressed. I was unhappy, miserable, suicidal, and depressed from as far back as I could remember. And I don't know where that came from. It just, you know, I was miswired out the chute, I believe that. To this day, I was really miswired. Again, a liar, a thief, and then I became a drunk. And after flunking fifth grade and sixth grade and repeating it in summer school, and I go into junior high school. Now, my parents, I said my figment of my imagination, and certainly I was not doing anything they said. And in school, I was hyperactive, I was manic depressive, all the stuff they do nowadays. They didn't give us pills back then. So, you know, I just was oblivious and in my own world. But they finally decided there must be something wrong with me. I'm getting in trouble all the time. Of course, they don't know I'm getting drunk every weekend, but I'm getting drunk, you know, most weekends. So I get into junior high school and they send me to the school psychologist. And she gives me these tests. And she says, you are suicidal and depressed. Now, I got this mental block. I'm okay. You just asked me, I'm okay. There's nothing wrong with me at that moment in time. I have this wall up. I am not going to get anybody, give anybody what's going on in my head. Of course, she was right, but I wasn't there. I'm in my shell. I'm not going to let anybody in, and I'm not coming out. And I remember thinking this. To this day, clearly remember thinking, lady, you're all wet. There's nothing wrong with me. You're crazy. And I believe that. I believe that bullshit back then. I absolutely believe that. Anyway, a couple of significant events happened. God was watching out for me. And I realize that looking back now. By the way, I don't believe that any of us get into AA or get clean and sober that other people are not praying for us. I absolutely believe that. I know that I had an aunt praying for me, a godmother praying for me, my parents maybe praying for me. I had neighbors praying for me. I know that to this day. I called up my aunt one Mother's Day and I said, I know you prayed a lot for me. And she was Catholic. And she says, I still am. So God was watching out for me in little things, but they were brief moments. You know, I didn't have any self-honesty. I didn't have any ability to look at myself. When we read How It Works and it says people are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves, I always wonder, what does that mean? I don't understand it. And now I view that as, at that moment in time, I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. When I could finally get honest with myself and see the truth, then I was no longer constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. Because without that, I couldn't be here without that honesty. So anyway, my older brother, 17, I was 15. He was given a choice, going to service or go to jail. And I thought to myself, self, you'll be lucky if that's all that happens to you, because I will be 100 times worse than he is. And I knew that. I was crazy. I knew that. So I straightened up and started doing schoolwork and bringing my grades up and trying to behave. When I was 17, I went to a movie with a date, and James Bond was sold out. God had other plans. I got a date, want to go to a movie. The only movie that had seats in it was Days of Wine and Roses. Now, if you haven't seen that movie, see the older people, they know that movie. Won 8 Academy Awards. I suggest you get it on DVD and watch it. It's a good movie. And it showed the progression of alcoholism by a couple in San Francisco, and they end up on Skid Row. The wife never gets sober. The husband does. He's in an AA meeting. And I watched that movie, and I came out of that movie, and I knew that was me. I'm going to end up on Skid Row. I knew that at the time. I knew that immediately. So that was that one brief moment. I actually quit drinking. I'd like to say I did it for 3 months, but I don't know what I really did it for. Some period of time, till she broke up with me, or till whatever. I tripped over my shoelace, or whatever reason I had to pick up a drink again. And so that didn't last long, but that was the first time I quit drinking. So my story is one of trying to quit drinking and stay stopped, or trying to control my drinking till I got here. That's just my story. I managed to graduate, and I managed to graduate and take math and science in high school, which was very lucky for me. It certainly helped me in my life. So again, I now know that maybe God was doing things for me that I couldn't do for myself without me asking for it or knowing about it. So I finished high school now. I went to a 2-year community college, and this became the first time I really tried to control my drinking. So I set out to only drink on Friday night and Saturday night, maybe Sunday night, and summers, you know, when I'm off semester. And I was able to do that. And I was able to get through community college. So at that age, I could control my drinking to that point. But whenever I started drinking on Friday night, Saturday, or whenever it was, there was no stopping. There was no stopping. Once I pick up a drink, and my first sponsor, he talked about the third step this way. I take my bottle of vodka, and I could take a sip out of that bottle of vodka, and I have just turned my will and my life over to the care of that bottle of vodka, that John Barleycorn, knowing I was going to drink the whole thing, probably black out, hurt the people I love, do things I wouldn't normally do. I drive drunk. I could do, and I'd be doing all these things, you know. But at that point in my life, did I want God in my life that I can't see, can't touch, can't feel? I'm not talking to me about that. So anyway, I was able to control it. 2 years. Vietnam's going on. I'm going to get drafted. Finished my 2 years of community college, one required course, so I didn't graduate. I got a solution to my life. It's going okay, but you know, I'm going to Vietnam. Now, I tell you, a guy who's smart is going to Vietnam and going to get shot at probably would not think of getting married. But I needed that solution. And you know, we hear in AA, sick attracts sick. So my first wife was not an alcoholic, an addict. She was not a really bad person, but she had her own baggage. And we were two sick pups. So that marriage lasted 7 years. Got drafted, drunk my way through basic training, which we weren't supposed to do. I knew I wasn't an alcoholic in basic training because I'd run up to the beer hall during study time and we had 3.2 beer. I wasn't supposed to be doing that. I'd buy three beers, have them take the top off one, guzzle it down, put two in my belt, order three more, do the same thing, a couple more in belt. I'd have pockets and belt full of beer in my fatigues. I'd run back to the barracks for bed check, put them down in the basement. And after bed check, I'd go down and finish all my beers. And the guy next to me in formation, he was a real alcoholic. Because he took Sterno and cheesecloths and strained the alcohol out of it and drank it. And so I had somebody to compare to. I got that keen alcoholic mind. Nothing wrong with me. I'm just having this half a dozen beers. Anyway, I get through basic training, go through advanced training, drink my way through that. I go to officer school. 6 months, I don't drink. Very restricted training. Get commissioned an officer and a gentleman. I love the line in the big book when it says, why don't you drink like a gentleman? You know, or if you're a lady, why don't you drink like a lady? Why don't you drink like a gentleman? I got a piece of paper that says I'm an officer and a gentleman. I can drink like a gentleman. Not only that, my pay went from $145 a month to $350 a month. Get to move off base and go home with my wife now for the first time in 6 months. So I stop on the way home and I buy a 6-pack of Michelob because I can buy expensive beer now. And the advertiser told me Michelob is... Gentlemen must drink Michelob. I believe that day. I drank a couple beers. Well, the next night I'm going home and I only got a couple beers left. So I buy a case and I drink most of it. That's the story of my drinking. You know, that's what got me here is when I could finally see that that's the story of my drinking. I can't stay stopped. Anyway, I go next to flight school. And I set out to control my drinking again. And I was able, but it's a 9-month training course. So I started out only drinking on Friday night, Saturday night, maybe Sunday night. But then they have a Wednesday night beer bash. So I got to drink Wednesday night. By the time 9 months were up, I was drinking every night. Vietnam's going on. They need a lot of helicopter pilots. So I became a pilot. And I never got fired from a job for drinking. And you know the lies we tell ourselves. It took me a lot of effort to convince myself I wasn't an alcoholic. I mean, it took a lot of effort, a lot of lying to myself. And I always love the honesty. It talks about, you know, get honest, open-minded, and willing, you know, how it works. Because the lies I kept telling myself. Never had a DWI, which is true, but that was a different time. I drove drunk 1,000 times, more than 1,000 times. So I never got fired from a job, but I get over to Vietnam and I'm drunk every day. And the boss says, you know, you're not doing so well in this job in 3 months, so we'll give you this other job. He never talked about my drinking. 3 months later, the same thing happens. He moves me to a lesser job. Never said anything about my drinking. 3 months later, same thing happens again. I got fired 3 times. The truth was, it's for drinking. But I couldn't see that at the time. Constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. I get through there, I come back to the States, and I go over to Germany. And Germany was a good, significant time in my journey to get to AA. I had a boss over there, and his religion did not allow him to drink alcohol. But we all knew he started with half a canteen cup, a big cup of scotch, and half coffee every morning. And he had me over his house. I'm so thankful and indebted to this man, because he had me over his house one night and he showed me his book. By the way, the Army taught me about alcoholism and drug addiction. I had willpower by now. I finished officer school, flight school. I had lots of willpower. I had the willpower to keep lying to myself and drinking. And then I got education on AA, alcoholism, drug addiction. We had a lot of problems back in the 70s in the military. And so I'm over in Germany and a lot of problems in the units over there. And so anyway, this boss talked to me, got out the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and showed me chapter 5, how it works. And he said, Rich, he said, this program hasn't helped me, but maybe it will help you. And I'm forever indebted to that man. And I will say 3 years after I got sober, he got sober. He was a West Point graduate. He lost both his feet in a car accident, was medically retired. It took a ways down for him to get it. But I'm always indebted for the time he spent talking to me. Next thing that happened to me over there is my next job was as a company commander. So I had 200 people under me. And I spent the majority of my time, of course, dealing with the problem soldiers. And I sent some to AA, and some couldn't help, so processed them out of the Army. I used to have what I call the three-strike rule. And that is, you know, a young soldier gets in trouble, minor trouble, okay, throw them out. Gets in trouble a second time, okay, we maybe give them a little administrative extra duty. Third time, maybe we take some money. Next thing, we're processing him out of the Army. He doesn't want to be there. That's three strikes and you're out. And I remember this pamphlet I read about alcoholism. And it said, if you, by your own definition or by your definition of your family or friends, think you have a problem with alcohol, then you probably do. And I remember this little bit of self-honesty creeping back in. My boss thought I had a problem. My wife thought I had a problem. And I thought I had a problem. And I remember this just as clear as all these other instances, saying to myself, crap, three strikes, I'm out, I'm done. But I'm still not ready yet. I got too much in me. I'm not ready for this yet. Anyway, I get through that that time over there, controlling my drinking off and on, quitting. I had a couple serious blackouts. Bottle of vodka called me one night. I take a couple drinks and black out, do something I wouldn't normally do. My wife gets me come to out of that blackout. I get up the next morning. I look at that bottle of vodka. I got this keen alcoholic mind. I have all the answers. I know how to lie to myself. I look at that bottle of vodka and it's got that much left in the bottom. I drank a fifth of vodka. Now, I got an answer for that. It's that vodka. From now on, I am only going to drink whiskey or beer or wine, but I'm not drinking vodka anymore. I don't think I lived up to that one. But I believe that stuff. You know, lying to myself. I'm good at it. I'm still good at it. I got to watch it. So anyway, I get laid off from the Army. Vietnam's over. They got rid of 60,000 officers, 30,000 of us pilots. I get my pink slip. I get divorced at the same time. I got a son at this time, about 4 years old. I get divorced. I go back to college, and I drunk out of college for two semesters, quitting the courses. I had the most unhappiest, most miserable year of my entire life. I did not know how to socialize. I didn't know how to do anything. I didn't know how to have friends. I didn't know how to date. I didn't know how to do anything except drink to oblivion. Well, my keen alcoholic mind is still working, being an officer and having some credentials. Let me go find a job. So I'm up in New York. I get a job down in Maryland. I get down to Maryland, and hey, I've since learned about what we call a geographical cure. You know, the only problem with what I was doing was I took myself with me. If nothing changes, nothing changes. So I get down to Maryland. Before my 30 days are up in my job, health insurance hasn't kicked in. I'm at a pool party. I'm drinking pretty heavy, playing touch football. I lock my knee up 90 degrees. It's not moving. I come down, not moving. So now I'm on crutches and I'm waiting. No health insurance. Now, if you'd asked me at that moment in time, am I an alcoholic? I got a job. I got a checking account. I got a car. I got a credit card. Yeah, life's good. Honestly, I'm divorced. I just spent the most miserable year of my life. My checking account has no money in it. My car's got dents all over it. And the credit card is maxed out. And I got to pay for this knee operation out of my pocket. You know, two pictures. I love those two pictures in my life because I could see the one, I couldn't see the other yet. I couldn't see that till I got into AA and could look backwards. Put a rearview mirror on, we could see lots of things. I could see what a mess I made in my childhood and how bad I was to my mother. You know, I could make up for that in sobriety as much as I could, but I couldn't see that at the time. I couldn't see those two pictures at the time. I also knew after talking to this boss that talked to me about his drinking, that drank half a canteen cup of scotch and half coffee every morning. I remember exactly what I thought. All these times I could think what I said in my keen alcoholic mind. I can remember thinking, I didn't say it to him, he's my boss. If I ever drink like you do in the morning, I must be a real alcoholic. That'll be the end. I thought that, I didn't say it. So, sure enough, now I'm laid off from the Army. I funked out, drunk out of school. I got this new job and I'm on sick leave. I'm on crutches. Always had money for booze. I got my four walls, my apartment full of booze. I'm drinking every day, drinking every night. I can't, it really struck me that I can't drink in the morning. And so I love this keen alcoholic mind of mine and how I can lie to myself. And I swear I would pass a lie detector test for this one. So I'm getting up maybe 9:30, 10, I'm all hungover. I gotta have a drink. I got some shakes, my stomach hurts. I gotta have a drink. I can't take a drink in the morning because I still don't want to be an alcoholic. I don't want a God in my life. I don't want AA. I don't want anything to do with you people. By the way, I was reading one. Alcohol is a good solvent. Yeah, it dissolves marriages, it dissolves families, it dissolves jobs. Very good solvent. Dissolves all that stuff. And there I am. So anyway, I can't have a drink in the morning. I got to have a solution. I'll tell you, sometimes I'm amazed at what my brain does sometimes, did back then. I know, it's 10 o'clock. I can have lunch. I can have a beer with lunch. That's not drinking in the morning. Lie detector test. I did not drink in the morning. I drank at lunchtime. And that's what I did. And I did that for, I don't know how long. I don't know how long it went on. I say September 15th, it was a Labor Day pool party sometime in that time frame. And I stopped drinking one afternoon at 5 o'clock. Something said this time is different. That's all I knew. Something said this time is different. I went 24 hours without a drink. So now it's about five the next day, five or six, whatever it was. It was late afternoon. And I'm really hurt. And I got no place else to turn. As one of my friends says, there was no door number three. There was no door number three. It says in the book, God either is or he isn't. I had no place else to turn. I got on my knees, one knee is locked up already. I got on my knees and I said, God, if you just get me through tonight, I know it'll be all right. And I felt this peace. Now, if I can say one thing that's carried me through everything since that moment in AA, in this journey, is never forgetting that moment and that feeling. That was so powerful. There was no question in my mind after that, that there's some power up there. I have no idea. I still don't understand it. I didn't know it then, but I developed a relationship with the God of my understanding that grew only from that moment, that opening the door. Sam and I are talking. We're in the book in the Saturday morning meeting of We the Agnostics. And it's such a powerful chapter. That just opened the door. By the way, I don't think that it made me anything special that happened. That happens to many of us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. So a lot of people have that experience. What I absolutely believe, absolutely, in my inner core, I was so full of belligerent denial. I was not going to have anybody talk to me about God or anything spiritual. And God, his ultimate wisdom is beyond compare. If that had not happened to me, and I come into an AA meeting, and at the end of that meeting, everybody stands around, holds hands, and says the Lord's Prayer, I would not be standing here today if it wasn't for that event. I absolutely believe that. I believe that. God knew I had to have that. He knew it. I would not be standing here otherwise. So that opened the door. I went into a deep sleep. The next morning I got up, I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book. And a guy came out and became my first sponsor, and I dug into it. You know, I was ready. Took me a little while to think about unmanageability, restored to sanity, making sound decisions. I asked my wife, sometimes I still don't make sound decisions, but most times they are pretty good. Most times they're a lot better. The third step is really pretty easy, as I explained it. You know, I can turn my will and my life over to any bottle of vodka, or beer, or wine, or anything. I can just turn it over immediately to that. This is so much more powerful, so much better. And so that wasn't too hard after that. Fourth step, I talked a little bit about my childhood. I believe it's absolutely important. It says in the book, we go back as far as possible and look at it. And it's a continuing process. Stuff comes back now that I have to deal with, and that's okay. And go on down, making amends. We get down to the last three steps. Whether you look at the last three steps as being maintenance steps or you go back and review some of the other steps, it really doesn't matter, you know. However you view it, you just got to keep the journey going. And so going back to the journey and how powerful this journey is. Of course, meeting my wife and sober and getting married, picking up four kids and, you know, kind of muddling through at that point in time because I got busy with family and other things, but I stayed close to AA. I stayed reasonably active in meetings until I got transferred over to Germany. My first sponsor passed away. I got another sponsor, good guy. But when I went over to Germany, I went through a period of I sponsor me. And I always bring that up. And a lot of things happened during the 5 years we were stationed over there. Four deaths in my family that I couldn't get back for. There were births of grandchildren we couldn't get back for. There was a lot of things going on. but I didn't have to take a drink over it. But I got away. I went to AA meetings maybe once a week or once every other week. I was not very active in AA. I didn't get a sponsor over there. And what happened during that period of time was my behavior changed. I never picked up a drink, but my behavior changed. So people that know me now know I stick very close to AA. There's a story I always tell about the lions and the gazelles in Africa. The lions and the gazelles drink at the same watering hole during the day. Lions and gazelles right next to each other. When night comes, the gazelles get in this tight herd and the lions go hunting for dinner. The gazelles that are on the outskirts of the herd are dinner for the lions. Think about that. You know, like the story of the guy walking down his country path and he sees a snake there, and the snake says, "Mister, I'm dying. Would you please pick me up? Keep me warm?" "No, you're a poisonous snake. I'm not going to pick you up." "Oh, please, I promise I would never bite you if you saved me." "No, I can't pick you up." "Oh, please, mister." "Well, okay, yeah, pick him up, put him in my coat." And he goes walking down the path, and finally the snake warms up and he gets all better. And he says, "Oh, I'm feeling so much better now." And the snake turns around and bites him. He said, "I thought you said you wouldn't bite me." He said, "I'm a snake. What do you think? I lie to you." Whenever you think of picking up that bottle, pop that top, or whatever it is, think about that snake. Don't let him bite you. So anyway, my behavior changed, but I didn't pick up a drink. And I didn't do anything that got me in any serious trouble. We lost a daughter-in-law, 30 years old. She had colon cancer. Doctor said she was in remission for about a year and a half, and then it came back with a vengeance. The doctor said she was going to live 18 months and die a cruel, horrible, painful death. She only weighed 90 pounds to begin with, and she didn't weigh 45 pounds when she died. She was bedridden most of that 18 months. My wife came back and forth every other month to help take care of her. Part of life. Part of life. The other thing, some really interesting things happened too, some really positive things. My sister-in-law went underground. She had a DUI. She had a different lifestyle. She was ashamed of it. I don't know if she was really even an alcoholic, but she just, in her lifestyle and whatever. And she went underground. Nobody had seen or heard from her for 10 years. One of my stepdaughters said to me, "I'm going to pray for Aunt Margie." And I said, "I'll pray with you." So we did that, and we prayed for Aunt Margie. Now, I don't know the time frame. I don't remember the time frame, whether it was a month, a couple months down the road. We were living in Atlanta at the time. Big city outside Atlanta, 1 million people. I belong to a World War II flying bomber museum in Indianapolis, another big town, big city of another 1 million or so people. And that bomber was in Oklahoma City. And they were on the ground, but they had an engine problem. They had to get another engine. They called me up. And so another city of 1 million or so people. And they said, "Can you fly up to," I had a small airplane, "fly up to Indianapolis, pick up this other guy and fly out, help us put an engine on this plane." "Sure, I'll do that." I fly up, pick him up, fly out to Oklahoma City. We land out there and there's a bunch of guys there all ready to help. And they got an engine in, and it's 7 o'clock at night. We all go out to eat dinner. We're in this restaurant. We all have this nice dinner. About 10 o'clock, guy's up paying the bill. We're all standing there. And I turn around and I look, and there sitting in the booth is my sister-in-law. And she wanted to be found. Now, you can't make that stuff up. You can't come from three cities that size be missing for 10 years and have that just happen. It doesn't work that way. It can't happen that way. I can't make that happen. So we have tragedies in our life. We have positive things in our life. What I do know is that as long as I can keep my focus, I'm trying to do the next right thing. When I got custody of my son, I always wondered, did I make that right decision? It was hard on him. That was a tough one. My first sponsor always said, you know, you make a decision based on what you know was best at the time, the best information you have. And so I trusted that decision, but it also doesn't mean that I didn't sometimes think about it. You know, was this the right thing to do? And he's doing fine. He's married and he's got a good life. Done well, but you never know. And until 30 plus years later, when my ex-wife died and my son was trying to help her, and my son calls me up and he says to me, "Dad, I'm sure glad you raised me and not Mom." Whoa, I didn't know for sure that that was the right decision for over 30 years. I felt it was. We never know. We make decisions, like my sponsor said, if I knew to do something differently yesterday, I would have done it differently. The next thing that happened was his wife calls me up about a week later and said, "I'm sure glad you raised him." And I was bothered. What else goes on? The things that go on. Circumstances that play out. Another guy I met in the Army, a surgeon, a flight surgeon, who's in the program. I met him in Alabama. Actually, I have to tell you about, developing this relationship in this spirit world. I view a human body and a spiritual body. And in many ways, they're separate. They're together, but they're separate. There's a spiritual being in me, and there's a human thing in me. The human thing gets sick. Bones get broken. I was born with a terminal kidney disease. I got a kidney transplant today. I had 13 people offer me a kidney. If I was still a drunk, who would have offered me a kidney? It's been there for 15 years now, and it's working great. I had a wonderful niece that finally, the early ones couldn't pass the medical screening. So it wasn't that they didn't want to give me a kidney. They couldn't pass medical screening. So a wonderful niece came along and I got a kidney from a wonderful niece, and it's still working fine. So for me, I believe I was born an alcoholic, miswired brain, whatever. The old timers used to talk primary and secondary. Some people cross a line later in life. Some people just seem to be right out the chute. It's going to hit me. And I was told early on, no why questions. It does not matter why. It does not matter why I was born with a terminal kidney disease. Couldn't help it. It's just a physical ailment. My parents didn't wish that on me. God didn't wish that on me. But I was born with it. In my case, I believe I was born with this miswired brain. I was predisposed to alcoholism. No question in my mind. Doesn't matter why. When I could get honest with myself, and I knew of this solution, and I'm very, very fortunate to have seen that movie Days of Wine and Roses at 17 years old, and then have other instances where God was watching out for me and things put in my life to help me see that at 29. That's the only reason I'm here. And the only reason I'm here with a few 24 hours of sobriety is trying to live the way this program teaches me to live. That's it. Putting one foot in front of the other. I was about 2 years sober, and I was down in Alabama going through some training and learning to fly twin engine airplanes in the Army. And my dad was a cook in just upstate New York, Bear Mountain Inn, and a short order cook. That's what he did all his life. I was sound asleep. There's an hour time difference. I was sound asleep. And it was about 1 a.m. when I sat bolt upright in bed, bolt upright. I knew something happened. I had no idea why. I'm in Alabama. Don't know. I sat bolt upright. I just knew something happened. The next morning, I found out that my dad liked his little nips, and it's a mountainous area up where he worked. He drove off the side of the mountain at that moment in time. Didn't kill him. He ended up in the hospital and he lived banged up pretty good. And at that moment in time, that's what happened. How does that happen? How do I sit in Alabama, 1,300 miles away, whatever it is, from where he was in New York, in his spirit world? That opened my mind. That really opened my mind at 2 years sober. I have to grow this spiritual journey. And so I really believe that the spiritual journey, or this journey that we're on, is what it's all about. And, you know, we used to talk, God will not give us more than we can handle. I remember old times we had meetings on that. Or God will give us the tools to handle any situation. And I believe that wholeheartedly. So losing a daughter-in-law, 30 years old, to cancer was tough. And it was really tough because my wife came back and took care of her every other month for 30 days. And her mother took care of her the other 30 days. And my stepson stood by her for the whole time. What a powerful example he is. He's not an alcoholic, but he's a gentleman. He's what we strive to be. He's where I want to be as a real gentleman, as a real man, you know. The whole goal is for me to try and continue to change my behavior, continue to get better. So open to the spiritual realm, open to the journey. It took me 25 years. Go back to the fourth step. It says we listed people, institutions, and principles. The reason I go back to that is because I said way back when that I told my friends I was never going to set foot in church again. And it took me almost 25 years in sobriety to honestly set foot in church again. My first sponsor was very good. And went through the steps to the best of my ability. But I missed principles and institutions. I miss those 2 points. Those few people here have done step studies with me where we go through a 13 weeks with a step study. And I know I beat that point to death because it's important, because that's a mistake I made. Not intentionally, didn't matter. So listing principles and institutions. Church is an institution. Doesn't mean I have to be a member of the church. It doesn't say that. But I had to deal with my resentment against it. Honesty is a principle. I got fired from a job my first year sober for stealing from a job. I wasn't smart enough to resign ahead. I'm not the brightest guy in the world. You know? And so that's a principle. So I really encourage, as you go through these steps, you do them to the best of your ability. And if you have to, you go back and do them again and do them again. So I finally work all that stuff in, you know, it's the journey. So things happen in my life. Right now I'm waiting to find out about whether I'm gonna get radiation treatment for prostate cancer. If you're a man and you're 76 years old, well, probably gonna be hit with something like that. And I'm not worried about it. I am absolutely, my poor wife, I pray for my wife. She is really worried. She needs prayers. Me, it's going to be okay. It's going to be what it is. You know, I learned early on in this fellowship, if I die tonight, I will die sober and happy. I do not spend any more time being miserable, unhappy, suicidal, and depressed. I would be lying if I said it's been 100% that way since I've been in AA on this journey. But I can tell you, it's been 99% that way. To compared to what it used to be. And, you know, in the 24-hour book, any 24-hour books in over there? No? The old 24-hour meditation book, the little black meditation book, we still sell them at the Anti-Length Group. In the front of that book is a Sanskrit proverb. It says, look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course, by all, the realities and verities of existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of action, the glory of power. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But each day, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. And thank you all.